That psalm is one long exclamation. It's a cry of amazement. Here you've got the psalmist just crying out because he's looked around him and he's astonished. He's astonished at God. He's astonished at the sort of God that he has. O Lord, O Jehovah, O Yahweh, our Lord, our Master, our Governor, our Ruler, how majestic your name is in all the earth. O God, you're amazing. And your name is awesome. Do you understand what he means when he says, your name is majestic in all the earth? There are some people whose names inspire awe. I suppose it was like that in the days of the British Empire. On far-flung shores, if you only mentioned the name of Victoria, people fell back in awe. They knew something of the greatness, the majesty of that woman, and her name was sufficient to inspire awe. The psalmist says, your name, Jehovah, is majestic in all the earth, everywhere on earth. If people catch a glimpse of your reality, your greatness, they'll be forced to worship. They'll be forced to recognize how utterly majestic you are. And where do they see God's glory? Where do they see the grandeur, the majesty of God? How can they see it in all the earth? Well, they see it in the things that God has made. That's what's moved the psalmist to this outcry of amazement. He's looked around him. He's looked at the earth around him. He's looked upwards at the heavens. And he's overwhelmed. There are three things I want to draw out from this psalm briefly tonight. The first is simply this, that God's glory is displayed in all creation. God's glory is displayed in all creation. In verse 1, it's the earth that the psalmist is thinking about. He's looking around him at the earth and the things in the earth. And he says, those things fill us with a sense of God's majesty. And they do, don't they? Anybody who simply opens his or her eyes and just looks at this earth around us and the things that are in this earth surely will be moved to a sense of amazement and awe. I was just jotting down from my sickbed some of the things that I can remember filling me with a sense of awe at the greatness of God the Creator. I can remember walking down a path through a rhododendron grove, and the rhododendrons hung over the path from both sides. It was astonishing, the colour, the beauty of it. But I didn't find myself praising the rhododendrons. I found my heart crying out, how great is the God who could make a scene like this. I can remember seeing a single green shoot forcing its way through a concrete floor. Tiny little bit of green life that had within it a power that would drive it through 12 inches of concrete. And I was filled with amazement at the thought of God who can create and put into a flimsy bit of plant that sort of driving power. I've seen a spider's web glistening in the morning sunlight. It's been so beautiful. And I found myself worshipping God. I've picked up a single, perfectly smooth pebble on a beach and just held it in my fingers. And yes, I know the natural forces that have shaped it. I know about waves and about sand. But I know that behind those natural forces, there's a mind, there's an artist who shaped that pebble along with all the other thousands, maybe millions of pebbles on that beach. And I've been forced to wonder and to worship. I've watched a giraffe striding, running across the African veldt, ungainly and yet astonishingly graceful. And I found my heart leaping out for joy to worship the God who made the giraffe. I've seen close-ups of a snowflake. Just the complexity of the design. And then to think that every one of the snowflakes is equally complex and each one of them unique. And I've been left awed, speechless, but knowing that I owe to God, the Creator, worship, love. I've seen a rosebud. It's beautiful. Beautiful. I've seen from the Cape, I've seen whales frolicking in the ocean. And they're his whales. They're, and they're fantastic. And they've made me want to worship and know this God. I've seen close-ups of a human knee joint. I'm interested in them. Have you ever seen a human knee joint? What an astonishing bit of engineering. Every part perfectly shaped, perfectly jointed, to fit with every other part. And if you look after it, capable of carrying on operating for 70 or 80 or 90 years. Amazing. And I've been forced to worship the God who designed the knee joint. I've looked at a panda with his comical black eyes. Looks as if he's done 5 rounds with Mike Tyson. And I've just felt bubbling happiness inside myself at the thought that the God who makes huge, grand things is also capable of making comic things and enjoys them. I've seen film of a human heart just pumping like a metronome. Hundreds of pints of blood, doing it day after day, week after week, year after year, human lifetime. And again, I've been filled with awe. I've seen a tiger, and it's sinuous. And it's terrifying. And it moves so sleekly. And it's beautiful. And in it I caught a glimpse of just the fear that's owed to the Lord who made the tiger. I've held each of my babies in turn within a couple of minutes after it was born. Each of my babies I've held in my arms and I've looked down at them. and I've counted five little fingers on each hand, five little toes. And I've been awed by the perfection of each of those babies. And the fact that it was God who made them. Those are just some of the things that have filled me with a sense of God's greatness. That have caused me to say, yes, the name of Jehovah is majestic. Some of you know more, much more than I do, about the things that God has made. Some of you know something of the complexity of the human, of the cell, the living cell, in any organism, in the human body. We were watching a video about that just a few weeks back, weren't we? It was awesome, but some of you been studying those things for years. Some of you know about the complexity of the DNA molecule at the heart of each cell. It's mind-boggling. Some of you have looked at tinier things than those. Some of you have made it your life's work to study matter itself, the subatomic particle, the mysterious forces that hold matter together. And that can't be described in words, that can only be described in mathematics that you tell me are beautiful beyond words. But even with the eyes I've got, and even with my ears, and even with my nose and my fingers, there's enough in the earth around me to leave me overwhelmed by God's greatness. And that's where the psalm starts. It starts with the psalmist simply looking at the earth around him. And his mouth falls open and he says, how majestic is your name in all the earth. But then he turns his eyes upwards. And he looks up to the sky. And he says, you have set your glory upon the heavens. In other words, it's written across the heavens. I see your majesty, your greatness all across the earth. But wow, it's when I look up at the skies, it's then that my knees start to knock together. And have you found that? I don't think there is anything quite as awe-inspiring that fills us with quite such a sense of the majesty and greatness of God as the sky above us. To see the sun rising, to see it sweeping across the sky until it's at its full height, to see the sun blazing at noon, and then to see it declining again to the horizon, and to see the blaze of red glory as the sun sinks, and to know that that sun will rise again tomorrow, and again will cross the sky, and again will sink into the west. To be out on a moonlit night when the whole world becomes silver, and it's as if everything, I don't know why, everything just seems quieter, everything seems stiller on a moonlit night than any other time. And you feel you've got to walk almost on tiptoes through the world. And you realize that that silver orb in the sky, God put it there. It's God who regulates its moons. It's God who made it beautiful beyond words. And then the stars. To be out on an absolutely clear night, when there's no cloud, and when the moon isn't shining, and to see the starscape, and to begin to try to count the stars, and then to realize that what you first thought of as a star isn't just a star, that it's a galaxy. To catch a glimpse of the Milky Way, and to realize to realize that these stars, God knows every one of them by name, and he shaped them with his fingers. There's something in the human heart that can't but be awed. We were camping during the summer near Buttermere. Sheep in the next field, and occasionally in the field where we were camping. Griff tied up to the fence. I don't think the sheep were overwhelmed by the starscape above us. They didn't seem to notice the stars. Sure, Griff didn't. But for you and me, to look up into the sky, to see the stars in their uncountable multitude, in their beauty, there's something in us that it tears at us, and yet the pain we feel as it tears at us is also a joy beyond words. It's awe. We find ourselves worshipping almost without choosing to. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You've set your glory above the heavens. That's my first point, and it's a very simple one. God's glory is displayed in all creation, the earth around us, in the heavens above us. Secondly, God's glory can be recognized by the simplest person. God's glory can be recognized by the simplest person. The psalmist says, "From the lips of children and infants you have ordained praise, because of your enemies, to silence the foe and the avenger." There are some people who are conscious enemies of God. There are some people who are his foes. There are some people who have set themselves up as avengers. Back in Old Testament times, there might be many people that you've quarrelled with and who have got it in for you. But usually quarrels burn themselves out in the end. In the end, usually people who have got a grudge against you get over it. But there was one type of quarrel that people never got over. It was the situation where there was a family feud, where somebody from your family had injured or killed somebody from his family, and he now has set himself up as an avenger, and he swears he will never drop his grudge against you. He swears he will pursue you all his days. He swears that he will hunt you down, and that he will pay any price in order to harm you. There are some people who have constituted themselves avengers against God. They've got a grudge against him, and they are determined. They are absolutely determined, implacable enemies. They will use all their energy, all their intellectual skills, all their resources to do for this one great task of attacking God. We know of people like that in the present day. Some of them get a great deal of publicity in the media. People who will write books and set up websites and stick placards on buses and demand changes in legislation, all to attack the very idea or thought of God. And you wonder at times what's motivating them. Well, those people, these avengers, these foes, they say all the time, that there's no evidence that God is even there. They say all the time that we don't owe anything to any God. They say all the time that God is a figment of our imagination, or that if he is there, that he's not worthy to be worshipped. Sometimes they can say the most inconsistent things. They can say on the one side he doesn't exist, and secondly that he's the most evil despot imaginable. They say, I know he's not there and I hate him. There's no rationality about it. But here are these people, and some of them are very brilliant and very intelligent. Some of them are very powerful people, very good at their jobs. And here they are devoting all their energies to attacking God and denying his glory. And the psalmist says, one little baby opening his lips can show that they're wrong. You know, on that camping trip last summer, on one of those starlit nights, we woke John up, our 4-year-old, and came round, and we carried him out of the tent, and said, John, we want you to open your eyes, and we want you to look up. And he opened his eyes, and he looked up at the sky, and you saw his eyes getting bigger and bigger. He'd never seen anything like that. He'd never seen the skyscape in all its grandeur. You don't see it here, do you? In town, where there's so much light pollution. And I said, what do you think, John? And he said, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. And for the rest of the holiday, he wanted to talk about that. About the sky. And about how wonderful God must be to have made a sky like that. One child, one infant, smashes all the propaganda of the atheists to bits in a moment. They're saying, there's no evidence that God is there. And John says, excuse me, I can see it. He knows. He knows that those stars were put in place by the Creator. He knows that a God of unimaginable beauty and grandeur created that sky. He knows. The wise, the profound, the learned, they may look up at the sky with their eyes closed and say, God's not there. It takes one child like John to silence the foe and the avenger, to show the emptiness and the futility of their lies. You know, it is such a cheap bit of rhetoric that we're hearing from people all the time. There's no evidence. There's no evidence for God. There's no evidence that this world was made. There's no evidence of God. Just show us some evidence. Every single star in the sky shouts the reality and the glory of God. Every single pebble on the beach shouts out God's creative genius. Every single snowflake shouts out the beauty of God. Every living cell, every single thing that is made reveals God. But sometimes it takes a child, sometimes it takes a baby to actually say it. You know, if I were to say to John, but you know, no, those stars, they just came out of nowhere, they came out of nothing. I know because a scientist said so, or a pseudoscientist. John would think I was pulling his leg. John would think I was deliberately saying stupid things. He knows that sky, those stars were made. Just as he knows that snowflakes were made, and that knee joints were made, and that griff was made. babes and sucklings can know these things. And then the third thing in the psalm, and this is really the heart of the psalm. This is the thing that amazes the psalmist more than anything. God's glory is to be shared by man. God's glory is displayed in all creation. God's glory can be recognized even by young children, the simplest people. God's glory is to be shared by man. The psalmist looks up at the skies, beautiful, awesome, vast. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him? How can you, a God who's capable of making all of that and controlling all of that, how can you think of us in our tininess as being important? How can you care about us? That's what amazes him. And the amazing thing above all is this, that this God who made that sky not only cares about human beings, not only cares about man, but that he plans to share his own glory with man. Do you see what he says in verse 5? You made him, that's man, humanity, the son of man, you made man a little lower than the heavenly beings, and crowned him with glory and honor. Now, in verse 1, glory is God's glory, the glory that's displayed in all creation. But now, it's man who must be crowned with glory and honor. God the King over all creation, the God whose glory is displayed in all creation, he's decided to put a crown on man's head. He's decided to enthrone man, humanity, human beings, to share his glory. The glory and honor that belong to God the King are to be shared with man as king over all creation. How big is man's destiny? According to this psalm, you made him ruler, that's you made man ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet. The psalmist believes that that's man's destiny, to rule over every created thing, to rule over this earth, to rule over the heavens, to rule over everything that God has made. God made it all for man, and he has appointed man to be king over it all. You put everything under his feet. He's sure that the day will come when everything in all creation will be ruled over by man, by humanity, by human beings. All flocks and herds, all the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. This was what God laid down at the beginning, at creation. When God made man, or when God resolved to make man, these were his words: let us make man in our image, in our likeness. And let them rule over the fish of the sea. Let them rule over the birds of the air. Let them rule over the livestock. Let them rule over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground. And then when he created them, he blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea. And the man was created to be a king and to have creation as his kingdom. No wonder the psalmist is awed. He's looked at the earth with all the unbelievably splendid things, great and small, that God has created. He's looked at the heavens in all their vastness. And then he says, and God made it for us. God made it so that we could rule over it. God made it to be our domain, our kingdom. You know, if you were to visit one of the great stately homes, let's say Chatsworth, it could be a very exciting, a very awe-inspiring visit. You wander from room to room, and everywhere you look, there are amazing things. There's beautiful furniture, there's fantastic wall hangings, there's marvellous carpets. You wander through the grounds and you see the gardens in all their beauty and splendour. And you come to the end of the tour and you say, that was amazing. But there'd be another dimension, wouldn't it? If Chatsworth or any of these stately homes were to be yours. If you had suddenly been told that you were the long-lost heir to the estate. So that when you're wandering through the estate, you're looking and saying, and this is mine. And that's mine. And you mean those are for me? Those forests, those belong to me as well? You mean that waterfall is mine? Be a completely different dimension. But that's the way that the psalmist now is walking through the world. He's walking through the world, and everything that he sees, he can say, was made for us. It was made for human beings who share the image of God and who are to be crowned with glory and honour by God. Now, the psalmist understands very clearly that man hasn't yet entered into this final destiny. That's why he says in the first half of verse 5, you made man a little, or for a little time, lower than the heavenly beings. At the present time, there are all sorts of unseen forces, unseen spiritual powers that very effectively have power over us. There are angels whose power we can't challenge. And there are demonic forces working through the whole of the created order. There are forces that bring disease and pain and death, who haunt us with fear. This world is a world overshadowed by the power of Satan and legions of fallen angels. And for a little while, we have been made little lower than those forces. For a little while, they do oppress us. For a little while, they do seem to have the upper hand over us. And for a little while, we don't have effective control over the physical order. Yes, we manage to tame some of the creatures to some extent. And we manage to subdue the earth to some extent. But we've not beaten the mosquitoes yet. And there are still man-eating tigers. And there are still viruses that threaten us. And that we can't do anything about. We're not yet enjoying our destiny. Yes, we enjoy this world, but we're not ruling it yet. We're not yet in full control of it. We've not entered into our inheritance yet. But this psalm is the triumphant affirmation that we will. The writer to the Hebrews, in the passage that we read at the beginning, Hebrews chapter 2, tells us how we know that we shall inherit, how we know that our destiny will be fulfilled. He says, we do not see everything subject to man yet, but we do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, or who was made for a little time lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor. There is one man who has entered into this destiny. Jesus Christ came down to be one of us. He became a real man. The Son of God took real human flesh, real human existence. And he lived here in this world. He lived here crushed by the spiritual forces that crush us. He had to experience the fear of death. He was hounded and tempted by Satan. He shared in our humanity, with all that that means, in order that we should share in his destiny. And now he has entered into his destiny. He has been enthroned as king with glory and honor. He can say, all power in heaven and on earth is given to me. He is the one man who has begun to fulfill the destiny of humanity. He's become the great forerunner, the great prototype man. Everything that Psalm 8 looked forward to has been fulfilled in Jesus. The psalmist could look forward and say, oh, one day man will be ruling. Will be ruling over the whole of creation. The writer to the Hebrews says, and now one man is. Jesus Christ is already in that position. He has defeated all the forces that challenged man. And he's done so on behalf of all those people who are joined to him. It's we who are joined to Jesus Christ who are now the real humanity, the real human race. People who don't belong to Jesus Christ are going to be cut off from the human race. They're not going to be human at all. The image of God is going to be cut out from them. But those who are joined to Jesus Christ, they're going to be really human. And because they're really human, because they have the image of God stamped upon them, they're going to inherit the universe. We quoted earlier in the service, didn't we? This verse, eye has not seen, ear has not heard, it's not entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those who love him. And those who love him are those who are joined to Jesus Christ. One day, Jesus Christ is going to lead me through my estate. He's going to take my hand and he's going to lead me through this universe that he's made for me. He's going to be swinging open infinitely beautiful vistas. He's going to be opening the doors of endless rooms and saying, I made this for you. It's yours. You're going to share it with me. And he's going to be doing the same with you. If you belong to him, it's all going to be yours. A whole universe. We hardly know. We just caught the tiniest glimpse of what glories and beauties and joys there are in this universe that God has made. But we've got all eternity to explore the restored universe, because it'll be ours. It was made for us. It was made to be our eternal inheritance. No wonder the psalmist is astonished. looks at the world around him and he says, oh, it's astonishing. Astonishing that God should have made such a world. And he says, but this is the more astonishing thing, that God should have made it to give to us, that God should have made it in order that we should share his glory, that we should reign over it, that it should all be ours. How excited would you be if you heard that you had inherited Chatsworth? Plus, of course, the money to run the estate properly. Not much point having it if you've not got the money to do it properly. How excited would you be at the thought of exploring the grounds, the gardens, the house? I would be. I've got an inheritance that I'm looking forward to that makes Chatsworth a pinprick. That's all it is. It's going to take all eternity to explore it properly. But then we've got all eternity with Jesus Christ.